Welcome back, or welcome to The It Factory presented by Zayo. I'm your host, Yogi Roth, and I'm so excited for today's episode. It's one of the world's leading high-performance psychologists, Dr. Michael Gervais. He's in the NFL for over a decade. He's worked with numerous Olympians, professional athletes, and he's got a great lens on what it's like to go through the mental side of high performance. We punch up to his office here in LA. I think you'll love it.
Gosh, that's a great question. I don't know if I've ever been asked that. Like, what is the It Factory?
The It Factory is back for season two. Last season, we explored what the It Factory is, who has it, and how they got it. This season, we still seek to answer the same questions, but with a new cast of characters. We take the helmet off some of the new faces in the Conference of Champions, and some familiar faces as well. Players, coaches, and experts will explore what it is that sets them up for success on Saturdays. I'm Yogi Roth, and welcome back to The It Factory.
Fired up to be back here in your studio. I was here on your podcast. Check it out, Finding Mastery. It's amazing. Michael Gervais. But to be here to do it in person, Mike, we thought like in 2023, as many in-person podcast conversations, the better.
Totally agree. Okay. And I'm stoked that we're doing this again. So thank you.
Yeah, we've been doing this since really both of us created a podcast, like once a year, at least check in on a platform to hopefully kick out to our audience. And a lot of the audience listening to The It Factory is players, coaches, and a growing number of parents. Ever since we wrote the book Five Star QB that Mike has wrote an incredible chapter to, all about leadership. With that said, I want to start with like mental skills. TJ, our producer, and I did a little research. Here's some numbers that you probably already know. 30% of just college students experience some symptoms of depression, anxiety, etc. And about 30% of those 30% seek help. When you look at athletes, only 10% of athletes seek help. And here we are in this world where destigmatize mental health, let's talk about mental health, resources within athletic departments and mental health. But as we see NIL, transfer portal, social media, everything growing, it seems like the number might be, I don't know if it's declining, or it's definitely not growing in terms of the people seeking help based on what we looked into. And this research was done by Athletes for Hope, which was founded by Muhammad Ali, Mia Hamm, a lot of people that we respect. So with that said, like, I want to jump off there on mental health for athletes. What have you seen? I want to share what I've seen and then kick off this conversation where I'm going to be parent, I'm going to be player, I'm going to be coach, and hopefully get your advice as a high-performance psychologist on how I could operate this landscape in college athletics.
Yeah. Alarming statistic as well.
Which one?
Both of them. Okay. But the first one, that 30% of people are struggling in some respect in their life, is alarming in of itself, but that only 10% of people in the athletic population are actually seeking help. And we know that from another way into the conversation is that one of the capabilities that allows athletes to be great when the lights are on is that there is an overestimation of their skills and abilities. So writ large, athletes overestimate their skills and abilities.
So that's kind of like a good thing, right? Because like I got big dreams.
That's right. Yeah. And then the overestimation of my internal skills and abilities allows me to, in practice, believe that I can do it in games. And so when the delta might be the difference between the skills from the practice squad to the actual squad, there might be a significant skill deficit, but the internal belief and the overestimate that I can do something amazing is an asset in this respect. That is also probably playing forward in the not seeking for help. So an overestimation that I'm good,
yeah,
cuts both ways. No, I'm okay. Like everyone feels a little depressed or whatever, like, but I can't show it. I can't talk about it because of the social aspects of the definition of being a man, as well as the overestimate that I'm okay.
Yeah.
So there's it's probably multifactorial that's, and amongst other variables that are at play here, but those are at least two of them that perk for me.
Okay. So I was just at the Heisman in December. Caleb Williams, of course, won it from USC. You've been around him at the Elite 11. He had a line that I think will be remembered forever, which was, quote, "I was taught by my coaches to look in the mirror and like the man looking back." You recently said on one of your podcasts, your AMAs, was that Marshawn Lynch would strip himself naked, look in the mirror, and be like, Do I love what I see, who I see? I wonder, like, the conversations you're having with athletes now, do you think they like the man looking back, let alone love what they see in the mirror based on what you just referenced?
What age are we talking about?
College. Yeah. I'd call it like 17 to 23.
You know, it's writ large, it's hard to take a broad stroke and say yes or no to that. I'll say my experience first, and then I'll share what I think is happening for most people, is that at that age, I didn't know who I was. So how could I have loved something I didn't even know? Yeah. So I was playing a different game at that age, and I think a lot of people will recognize this. In that college years, we're trying to figure out, we're still in the game of identity. From a developmental psychological perspective, we're still trying to sort out who we are. And so it's really not until two or three stages, meaning we're in our 30s, from a developmental standpoint, do we start to have an understanding of who we are and how we express those gifts and abilities in whatever world we're in. So I think that the easiest answer is, not quite, because they don't know who they are. And that's by definition part of the developmental process. Now, the second lens is that right now, different from when I grew up, is that everything that I did was not on public display. All of my friends didn't know if I was included or not included. Social media wasn't a thing. We would wait 6 weeks to 8 weeks for a video to drop to be able to see what was happening in my sport, which was, you know, surfing. So we'd have to wait 2 months, sometimes 3 months, to see what the cool kids were doing, the pros were doing. And so our stuff was never public. Theirs was barely public. Now you could watch traditional stick and ball stuff on football and the like. You can watch that on the weekends, and you'd have to read about it in the newspaper. So it's dynamically obviously very different. And I think the game inside the secondary game, or the game inside the game that we're talking about right now, is more leaning towards approval and avoiding rejection than it is loving oneself. And so the fear of people's opinions is at an all-time high right now for my lifetime. I don't know how it was in the dark ages. I don't know how it was, you know, I don't know how it was historically, but the fear of people's opinions, more specifically, the fear of rejection and the deep drive for acceptance, is at an all-time high. So that's the primary driver for many people right now, is to not be kicked out of the club. We have a prehistoric, ancient brain that is easily hijacked. And the brain is trying to fit socially for survival. Yeah. So if we don't fit socially, it's likely we don't survive well. And if you add on top of that, that athletes, especially in your world, the college athletes that are exceptional at what they're doing and being scrutinized by the availability of media and the publication of social media, that level of forced ranking, scrutiny, inspection, commentary about one's skills and abilities, we're not ready for that. And that is such a loud variable in one's progression to become themselves. Because remember, go back and map it, that this stage in college is really marked by identity. Who am I? And you've got the world commenting on who you are based on what you do. So there's a confounding variable that is pretty radical right now. And in some respects, you know, I think about what success would look like for the next generation of kids, or this generation right now. Yeah. Tuning down the external noise and turning inward to understand the inner world that they're wanting to create is going to be a massive leverage.
What's interesting is I just spent 18 weeks on the road and calling games every weekend. So before a game, as you know, like, you'd have a production meeting where you sit just like this, across the table with coach, player, et cetera. I talked to more players this year in this setting about mental health than I did about X's and O's, dramatically more, let alone on the field after practice. And it was them expressing where they're at, how they have grown, what some of their challenges are. It was amazing to hear the awareness of the athlete going through that. But I want to pivot to now I'm the coach. Because there's an opportunity now. Like, I'm not just the X and O guy anymore. I'm not just a top-down hammer anymore. That leadership doesn't necessarily work very often, consistently with this generation. I think we'd agreed on that. But they have to have the ability to unlock certain things for these players. And I think coaches are struggling with that. So what would you say to that if a coach came into your office like, dude, how do I unlock that? Because I know how important and critical it is for the players and everything they're going through in their external world, as you said.
As a sports psychologist, fortunate to work with some of the most extraordinary coaches and athletes and performers. When I first entered the field, I would ask coaches, like, how important is the mental game? And I would ask them that, like a blanket statement. Like, naively, I didn't know what they thought about it. I knew that it was important for me and as an athlete growing up. And so I'd ask them, they go, oh, at this level, it's like the thing. I go, oh, like how much? 70, 90, 100%. Like when the pros coaches are talking about it. And so then I would ask the following question, well, how much time do you spend on training those skills? And they kind of the blank look like, what do you mean? You know, like, well, you know, we talk about it a lot.
Yeah, hand behind the line.
Yeah, how do you talk about it? You know, like, are you actually training the skills? So there's I haven't met a coach or athlete yet that doesn't say the mental part of the game is foundational. It's critical for success. Okay, so now we're getting to, we have the understanding and the appreciation, and there's a forcing function right now where people are paying attention to the value of it because people are not healthy.
Yeah.
And there's an illness factor that's taking place. And I cringe when I say the word, because mental health and psychology has a branding problem. It is foundational to living well. It is foundational to flourishing. It is foundational to thriving. It is foundational to high performance. It's foundational to understanding what you're capable of in this life. Without psychology or a sophisticated understanding about how to apply the science, we're floundering.
Yeah.
So we have a branding problem because the conversation is about mental health, which really is code for somebody is ill or weak or worse off, they just can't figure it out. It's too bad for them. Like, it's a terrible branding problem. We're starting to get a little bit better, but we need the cool kids. We need the coaches and the athletes that have influence and power in organizations to say, we're doing it differently. This is foundational. It's actually part of the process of becoming great. So a coach can start here by just acknowledging, for years I've been saying that the mental part of the game is really important. So we're going to make sure that we're great here in this program.
Yeah.
That statement alone changes the culture. It points people towards what to value in part of the developmental promise that we're making to each other. So if you're the coach and I'm the sports psychologist and we've got an athlete here, we're making promises to each other that we're going to commit to bringing our very best, to doing our very best, and helping each other become our very best together while we're in it, you know, on the shared mission called whatever badge that we're wearing on our jersey. Mm-hmm. That promises that we're making will involve the psychological and emotional part of it. And if we're not being honest with it, we're playing a different game. We're playing an outcome game. We're playing a game of money and numbers and approval, and we're playing a different game.
Yeah. Whenever I talk to coaches, I think the majority that I'm around, like, they are aware of how critical, as you said, like, mental skills are.
Yeah.
And you said a quote to us at Elite 11 maybe 5 years ago, and I've told you this, it totally made my life make sense. You said, optimism is at the core of resilience. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, my whole life made sense that day.
Yeah.
Because right. It was like, okay, no longer is it, hey, Yogi's always so upbeat, so positive. It was like, oh no, resilience. Yeah, that's why I'm so optimistic. I say that of like, coaches need to train resilience. They need to train that skill because it is one. What's an example? How do they do it?
So let's be really clear. The first order of business is to create air cover and to value it. So when a coach says that, that changes, like I said, the culture.
Yep.
So people understand like, oh, okay, this is how it we're going to do it here, yep. Right? It matters. And then they need to make it believable because they're practicing. So it's not something that those kids over there do. It's not something that happens in a poorly lit room in a comfy couch.
Yeah.
That's not where psychology only happens. It can happen there, you know, but it's way more dynamic than that. Okay, so those are the first beginnings. And what I just am suggesting subtly is that the coach is living it. They're working and practicing on developing those skills for themselves as well.
Yeah.
And the third element is to make the skills very concrete. So what I mean by that, psychology is invisible. We can't see thoughts. We don't know how much they weigh, where they go. Just like gravity, we can't see gravity. We don't know how it really works, but we see the artifact of gravity. We see what happens when something's falling. Yeah. We see how gravity, the impact gravity has on us all the time. Same with psychology. We can't see thoughts, but we can see the artifact. We can see the consequence of thoughts. And that is physiological. Okay, so this third element is making this invisible world not only cool, not only part of the culture, but making it concrete. And when we can make it concrete, it means that we are demystifying this taboo experience about psychology. We're saying, to your point earlier, optimism. Okay, great. So you mean that's related to resilience and mental toughness? Oh, that's something we can also train? By the way, optimism is only trained. We're not born optimistic or pessimistic, as best we can understand. So yeah, that's a trainable skill. Great. How do I train it? This is how we make it super concrete. And the concreteness, and we'll just play this thread all the way through on optimism, is you look at good science. So the field of science is relatively new. It's about 100 years old. And sports psychology is about 40 to 50 years old, let's call it. And there's great researchers that have spent their whole life deconstructing and decoding how do the best in the world work. That is the science of sports psychology. How do the best in the world organize their inner life and use their mind? Yeah. And that's what I was fascinated by as a graduate student. Like, how? Yeah. Majority of psychology, the larger part of the psychological field, is studying the dysfunction and the illness of the human experience. That's an important science.
Yeah.
We need to understand that. But that's not where my interests lied. So that smaller percent of the people studying human flourishing, call it sports psychology, is going to make these things incredibly tangible because athletes are concrete. They want to see and feel something that's real. They're attracted to that. And so how do you train optimism? Coming out of University of Penn, a very simple practice, three amazing things. So become the researcher of amazing. You say, well, what does that mean? You wake up in the morning, and there's good science that I'm anchoring to. You wake up in the morning and you are going to train a part of your brain that is less developed by default than the majority of your brain is to scan the world and find all the dangers, all the threats.
Yeah.
So it's a negativity bias. It's to find the dangers in the world. The research of amazing is to wake up in the morning and find all the things that are amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. So you go through your day, you make a commitment to yourself, a promise to yourself, like, I'm going to train that part of my brain. I'm going to scan the world and find amazing. And when I experience it, I'm going to go, oh, okay, this is one. I got one. And then later at night, you're going to bookend this process by just writing it down. Got it. It's a sentence. This is what was amazing. I got to see my friend Yogi today. And then in brackets, you write the emotional component of what made that special. And that's it.
Wow.
And according to science, if you can do three in a row, it changes people.
Yeah.
It stabilizes. If somebody comes into, people that came into that study in particular that reported to be depressed prior to this 7-day intervention of the researcher amazing, it stabilized their depression. 7 days.
Wow.
Stabilizing depression. That's better than psychotropics. That's better than many of this cognitive behavioral training and therapy results that we see. Those that came into the study that were not depressed, so doing pretty good in life.
Yeah.
They reported after the 7 days of an overall increase in well-being.
Let's just play it out. I'm a wide receiver coach at the University of Utah, mm-hmm. right? And we have a meeting before practice, like you've seen when you were in the NFL for a decade plus. Hey, what's one thing that's been amazing so far today?
That's exactly.
Oh man, I got to see my kids this morning. I took them to school, or I had a great English class. Whatever it was, my girlfriend and I are thriving. I had a great FaceTime with my mom.
And you want to make it really specific. Got and it. Then to your point, so you want the athlete or the coaches, say this is a coaching process. Yeah. So let's go up one level first, is that coach makes it cool, makes it part of the culture, and makes it concrete. Yep. How's he going to make it concrete? Well, the head coach doesn't need to understand what I just said about the researcher of amazing. But the head coach would say, I want our team to be pessimists. No coach has ever said that.
Ever.
No coach has ever said, I want us to be cynics. I want us to believe that the future is going to be shitty. I want us to believe that it's not really going to work out. No coach ever says that.
Yeah.
So inherently coaches go, oh yeah, I want us to be tough. I want us to roll with it. I want us to figure it out. I want us to be scrappy. I want us to basically believe the future is going to work out. So let's keep applying. I want us to believe in the future, that the future is compelling. That's all springs from optimism.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. So the coach is going to make it, again, super concrete by practicing, by first understanding, like, what psychological skills do I want the people in my club to own,
yeah,
to have a command of, to be practicing? I bet you optimism is at the top of that list, but they might not know that word necessarily.
Yeah.
So that's why you call it a sports psych. Okay. You call a sports psych to be part of your roundtable. If, hey, head coach, love what you've done for men for a long time. And if you don't have a sports psych at your roundtable, look around and ask yourself who is holding the space that a highly skilled sports psych can do. And if it's one of your assistant coaches, like, I don't know, they're probably better at X's and O's, you know, yeah, than they are on the science of psychology. So have them on your table, your round table. And then what they do is what we did at the Seahawks, let's say, is I would train the coaches on what these core psychological skills are. And then the coaches train the athletes. Yep. So old sports psychology, 20 some years ago, 40 years ago, was a head coach would say, hey, the mental part of the game is really important. Hey, sports psych, can you work with one of my players? Okay, which player? Well, it's the one that like can't quite get it done on game day. Oh, you mean the one that has high talent, but everyone recognizes kind of is over anxious during games, like,
yeah,
you know. And the first book in sports psych written by Dr. Ogilvy was called A Solution for Problem Athletes. Actually, it's something about problem athletes. I don't have the exact title. And he was a mentor of mine. He felt so badly about that he was calling them problem athletes.
Yeah.
And he's like, I hope I didn't put us back like 10 steps, because they're not problem athletes. They just didn't have
the tools. Yeah.
Make it concrete.
Okay. So great stuff. So if I'm a coach, I'm listening to this and I'm like, okay, I can create the air cover. I can create optimism. I can talk about amazing. Like, I got my tools. Now, welcome to the world of 2023. Oh, about 2,000 players in the transfer portal. I can dip into that thing every time. And from my lens, I wonder how coaches are viewing their relationship with athletes. Because if I'm your coach and I recruited you, Mike, out of high school here in Southern California, and I recruited you for 3 years, you came to this university, I've trained you, and then you dip on me. Now everybody's dipping. A lot of guys, the vernacular in college athletics is, I'm going to go check out my quote-unquote portal value. So if I'm a coach, I'm like, everybody wants to go jump in the portal. Like, I don't care about you anymore.
This is not new.
Well, I think the amount of players that are doing 2,000 players.
Well, okay, so this is what I mean by it's not new, is that what percentage of marriages are making it right now?
50%, right?
50%.
That's
what it is? Yeah.
That number is never, I feel like that's the number I've always heard.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. So that means that 50% of the time people are making a promise.
Yeah.
Let's do this thing. Let's have a great life together.
Yeah.
And then within a handful of years, something else comes along that is better for them. They've made a decision that something else is more attractive. Traditional psychology might study why things go sideways in relationships, and then sports psychology would study why things work. Okay, just as a, again, basic premise in the two disciplines. And it's not quite that clear always. So what is it about the relationships that work? What do they do? They invest in each other.
Yeah.
They create a compelling future. They understand the relationship that they want to have, and they work toward it daily. So the relationship is at the center of marriage, yeah, right? But it's the way that you allow and create and support and challenge the other person to become.
Yeah.
And those are the relationships that stick. And so if the athlete and the coach is a relationship, and the coach and athlete haven't created that shared vision that's compelling, and they haven't made the promise to each other and backed it up almost every day,
yeah,
and worked that relationship, then of course that's something that looks better is going to be really attractive.
Yeah.
And so we in sports psychology, we talk about mental skills training in this way, is we front load the training so that we, when we're tested, we have what it takes.
Yeah. I feel like what's happening now is, like, to use the analogy of what you said of marriage is not working, like in college football, like the marriage worked because if you left, you had to sit out a year.
That's right.
Right. And you never necessarily got like a sweet deal to go to another school. So now the floodgates are open and it's like, oh, we're going to course correct. We're going to, because the numbers are now going to be about 50% when you look at it in probably 5 years in the last 20 years of college football. And then I think that coaches are struggling with, I have poured into you. I have done all the things. I've shown up. You've shown up. We have this amazing relationship. And then you're like, I'm going to check out my value because maybe my school doesn't have all the things
so,
to keep me.
So how do we work with that? And so I would say, coach, look, let's be really, if you're the coach,
yep,
and go, I'd say, okay, I hear what you're saying. First order of business, always to calibrate, make sure we're on the same page. I hear what you're saying is that you're really concerned about how much you're pouring into the kids and their well-being and their development. And you're also anxious that they're going to leave early. It's okay. What do you want for the kids? You say, I want the best for them.
That's
okay.
That's the pull, I think.
Right. So, so what do you want for them is where this starts, right? Well, we made a promise and like, I need them to stay. Is that best for them?
Good point.
Okay. So that's one variable to entertain, right?
Yeah.
Like, is this, if let's flip roles for a moment. Okay. And you are my dad. Okay. And I say, Dad, I got an opportunity. Coach wants me to stay. I got this opportunity to make millions on this other side. I got this other opportunity. You would say to me, you'd say, yeah, I want what's best for you.
Yeah.
Right. Not necessarily like, I know I'm being kind of provocative in saying this, but the responsibility of the coach, if the promise and the relationship really matters, is to support the development and the arc of that kid.
What's best.
For what's best.
Yeah.
But so this is one way to think about it. The second is, if that relationship is strong and it's amazing and every day you've really poured into the way the kid feels around you and the real body of work where improvement, both on field and off field, are happening, that if you're that kid, or if I'm the kid in this standpoint and you're the coach, and I go, I know that I'm going somewhere with you, and I'm going to be better later. Yeah. I believe in that because it's real.
Let's flip it to me being a player, right? So now I'm a player and I'm living in this world that I can get paid in NIL, which name, image, and likeness for those who are living under a rock on this podcast, or you can transfer. I feel like as guys are checking out their portal value, what a lot of them are losing is, as you've said this phrase a lot, is like a beginner's mind. Like, they're losing joy. They're losing passion. They're losing wonderment around the craft, because as many players have told me that have transferred, it's like, well, it's a business decision. And then halfway through the year, they're like, oh, it's about a team. It's not a bit. It's about fun. It's about the enthusiasm of our environment that I'm in, whatever it may be. But I think it begins as a business decision. And the ones that live just down the business lane, I feel like, are what a lot of NFL players say, which is like, it's my job. And I see a lot of the joy getting sucked out of college athletics. And as you see, and I see with Elite 11, guys are getting offered, at least reportedly, millions of dollars coming out of high school. Mm-hmm. And they don't know how to, A, handle that, don't have the tools to handle that. And I think the same even in the transferring world that we're seeing in this market now, where it's like, I got to make the best decision for me. It's a business decision. Cool. But now, like, how do I recapture, like, the love I have for this craft? What would you say to that athlete that you meet them and at 17, they were full of life, And at 20, they make a transfer, they make a decision that might be best for them, but it's all business, man.
So for a decade, I was part of the one member of the very large selection committee, if you will, for in the NFL, helping the Seahawks and John Schneider in particular and his team just try to understand like who the athlete is that we're interested in. Yeah. Like what is making them tick? Because you can see on tape, like the physicals, but what's making them tick? And part of that process would be to sit with them at the combine and ask them questions about like their inner life. And one of the questions was to try to get underneath and understand what their primary drivers are. What is their purpose is one way to think about it. And another is like, what is their core motivations? Most athletes and most humans know what they're supposed to say. I'm motivated by the love of the game.
Yeah.
I'm motivated by getting better. I'm motivated to do something special as a team. Okay. Money is a real motivator.
Totally.
And so let's not be Pollyannish, is that it's a motivator for me too. Like I want to be well compensated for the time that I spend. And I believe that there's a high value in it. I hope they have the same thought. Now, the question that you're asking is assuming that their primary motivation in college is for the love of the game. And then in the pros, it's changed.
Yeah, I think every pro that comes back to campus says the same thing in my 20 years, which is, man, in college, it's way more fun, guys. In the league, my guy sitting next to me, he's got three kids, it's a business. And I think that's cool to transfer to go get paid. Like, I'm in, I love NIL for the record, and I love the transfer portal. But what I don't love is where I see guys when they come into this new environment where now there's a dollar figure associated to them in addition to a star ranking, in addition to somebody else's vernacular thrown upon them. And how do they recapture the love for the game versus, all right, now I got to live up to this. I got to live up to this. I got to live up to this money.
Okay, so that's where I think the real conversation is. One is there's a moment to say, and only the athlete can really know.
Yeah.
What their primary drivers are. You know, like Marshawn Lynch, one of his practices, get completely naked, look in the mirror, and he would have a self-evaluation. Who am I? Do I love the person? You know, what am I really about? And so I would say to the athlete, you know, what are your primary drivers? And I want to tell you a story to illustrate this point. But the importance of knowing your primary drivers and then be true accordingly is very powerful. So that type of alignment is really important.
Yeah.
When people are playing a shadow game or a secondary game, it's like a leaky valve. There's a diffusion of potency in the world around us. But when we can line up our thoughts, our words, and our actions, and we line those up in alignment with our purpose, and the bumpers of this decision-making process are our virtues or our values. Right? So we're not gonna line up our thoughts, words, and actions and compromise our virtues for the purpose, right? And the purpose you can think about is another way of what's driving you. That alignment is really important. So here's just a story to illustrate it.
Okay.
I don't know, the number's probably like 200,000 people I've asked this question to. And imagine a room of 3,000 people and it's like a keynote type of thing. And I ask all of these executives or athletes, who's ever the audience is, how many of you want to have an amazing life? And then I pause, right? Everyone raises their hand, right? And then I pause and then I characterize it. I said, you know, it's one of two or both, a sense of wisdom and peace. And by the time that you slide into home base, you know, like you really have done something in your life, okay? And the other is that you slide into home base a little banged up, bruised, you've really gone for it. You've lived a life that's interesting. And you can have both. And people are like, yeah, that's what I want. And I say, would you agree that living that type of life of like, I call it flourishing, living that type of life, a high performance life, if you will, requires going for it and risk? Like, yeah. I say, would you also agree that like your motivations are gonna be an important part of that? You know, because they're pretty powerful. And they're like, oh yeah, it influences decisions. And you can see people kind of nodding their head, right? And then at the end of the day or at the end of that hour, I give people an opportunity to come on stage and to see how their mind works under pressure. And it's an innocuous question. I say, you know, this has been so great. I say, you know, I want to give you guys an opportunity. Who wants to come up right now in front of all your peers, in front of the 3,000 people here, and see how your mind works under pressure? How many hands go up?
Not as many.
Not as many. You know why? It's not because they don't want the amazing life. It's their primary driver is to not be rejected by their peers.
Yeah, FOPO.
FOPO.
There it is.
Fear of people's opinions. So this is why, like, when you get naked and you have that self-examination to really be honest with yourself, what are you driven toward and what are you driven by? What is your purpose and what are your core drivers? What is your motivation? And if it is money, well, then this decision to jump makes sense. Yep. If it is to buy your family a house and to set them up because that's a dream of yours, well, the decision makes sense. Now you have to weigh short-term versus long-term. And one of the ways to be able to measure that is, or to make that decision, is what is the quality of the relationship I have with my coach? Yeah. What is that? Do I believe that they're really in it for me? Do I have a body of work and evidence that I feel seen, I feel supported, I feel challenged, I feel like I matter, yeah, and my best interest is at heart? If that's the case, you go to your coach and you say, hey, coach, I want to work something out with you. You know, like, I'm feeling like I might be jumping ship and abandoning, and I know that, like, we got a good thing going, but whew, I got this other opportunity. Like,
Yeah, and my core driver is, yeah. That's a great one for coaches listening. Another wide receiver meeting room, right? Like, what's your core drivers? Mm-hmm. Let's write them down. Let's talk about them. Hold each other accountable.
One thing. Yeah. I wouldn't do it publicly. I would. I would do that. I would address it to the team, and then I would hold a sanctuary between myself and the athlete. Because if you do it publicly, everyone's going to say to win a championship.
Yeah.
You know. But then when you get them in a room and totally, like, so tell me really what is it?
Yeah.
Because I want to know that. And then the athlete now needs to make a decision. Am I going to say it because I'm going to take the risk of being vulnerable to that this person can hold this? I can trust this person that they're not going to use it against me. You know, that they're not going to weaponize my deepest desires and hopes and dreams. And that weaponization is a real thing that some coaches, now I'm going to speak right back to a coach, right? You hold a significant position in this person's life.
Yeah.
And if it's not pure, you're using them.
I've heard from so many parents. I just spoke at the Elite 11 Academy, which is like junior high. 200 quarterbacks, their families, like right around the corner here in Southern California. And it was amazing to be in that room. Totally different than the room was a year ago. I'm in there with players who are wearing their own branded gear. Like, and it was cool because the kid was like, yeah, dude, this is sweet. I'm not selling it. I designed it myself. Like, the framework of athletes is different than it was just 12 months ago. And I just came from the national championship game. And watched Georgia, TCU. And I was at like one of the big hotels afterwards and I saw all the parents of players who I love. Like, who doesn't love a good parent, right? And they all had their players, their sons' jerseys on. Been going on forever. And it hit me as I was preparing to talk to you. Like, well, not only are the parents invested, of course, that's never gonna change. But now they're also like managing some of these players' careers. Now they're also saying, hey, because they've heard from an expert, I gotta grow my son's social media, but we also know the dark side of that social media, but if we wanna hit it in the NIL game, then we gotta grow that thing. And I think for parents, from talking to them, like, hey, like, I'm in this weird world of everything from money, transfer, recruiting, NIL. Should I hold my kid back a year in junior high so he could be the big kid? Like, those are real hardcore discussions. And I'm like, how can we help them? Like, how can we give them one or two things to think about? Because they're trying to navigate a world that, like, there aren't a lot of tools for it. They got your podcast. They got 5-star QB. I'm sure they got a couple other things. But there's not, like, a laundry list of resources.
Because what was happening while you were asking the question, I was like, God, thank God that you've got your podcast as a resource for this community. Like, so that's cool that you're doing this. And I think I want to make sure I'm say this clearly, is that my view of coaches is that they were attracted to the profession earnestly. They want to help. My view of parenting is they want their best for their kids. my view of athletes is that they are wanting to become their very best and be part of something special and have a future that they can believe in that's amazing and compelling. So I have a benevolence about how I think about this community. I also have a side of me that's seen other things as well that goes, there's exceptions to these rules. So to the parent, I would say the first question I say to you as the parent, I say, what are you getting out of taking this role with your son?
They'd probably say, if they're the manager, I'm protecting them. I'm looking out for their best interests, most would say.
And then I'd want to double click. I'd say, right, yeah, yeah. What are you also getting? And because early on, when an athlete is exceptional, adults treat them differently. So there's a foreclosure of their identity that takes place.
Child actors. Yep.
It's same with sport. Yep. You got a 13-year-old tennis player that is like the next hope in this community. They're whooping the adults. They're like the whole thing, like they're treated differently. So there's a stunting that happens there. And some parents are like, listen, sport is just really cool for my kid to figure out something. Like, I don't know. And they're not invested in the same way that some of the parents maybe that we're talking about right now are, the ones that want to be managers. And so I think it's really important as a moment to the parents to say, what are you getting? What is the gain that you're getting from taking this role of all the things that you could do in your life? And the easy answer is like, I want to protect my kid. Okay. So let's use the protection analogy one level deeper. And if we're talking about a shield, right? Like I'm thinking about armory and the shield. Do you have the biggest shield, you know, as a manager? Or would maybe a really exceptional manager that this is all they've done, would they be a better shield? So that's a decision to make. Is like, am I the best qualified in the role that I'm wanting to step into? Because my kid is counting on me to make this decision.
No, I've been talking to a bunch of parents whose children or their sons are the best player, right? Whether it's the NFL, like Lisa McCaffrey would say this about Christian, or parents of college quarterbacks that we know would say this about their kid. They're like, we go into a game and we see all the jerseys in the stadium. We have so much anxiety. We have no clue how to manage it because we feel like their performance will impact us because we love them. Like we're partly afraid of what's going to happen. We don't really know how to manage ourselves. Anxiety's overflowing us. And we know it's not about us, but it's still happening.
That's cool insight. That's a really cool insight. And this again points back to why it's so important for all of us to do our work.
Yeah.
And one of the principles that I think is really important for parents is that our job is to help our children flourish, to leave the nest and fly. And if we're not careful, we clip their wings early by being over-involved. And it's a dangerous proposition to be distant and to be overcommitted. Like there's no clear roadmap in how to do this. So I don't pretend to have an answer, but I can give you an analogy of two strong trees. And when one tree has deep roots, strong trunk, and the other has the same, they touch the branches, touch with each other. And that's a healthy relationship. The other is that when the roots grow too close together and the trunk is infused with the other trunk, that the branches don't fully flourish. So enough space, enough aeration between the two people is foundationally important. So I share that perspective as well, is that there is space in here to make mistakes that's important.
You said that this year for you is the year of play. A decade ago, you and I were in the ocean here in SoCal, and you inspired me with the idea of like, hey, let's create a word for the year. You remember the word we chose?
I don't.
Okay, it was go.
Oh,
we both committed.
Yes.
We're like, yeah, we're gonna go, right? And ever since then, like I've been tracking it for a decade. This would be year 10 of that. And I know you've been doing one with your community of finding mastery. So yours is play. What's like your main activator for play?
Spontaneity. So freeing up myself so that I can be fully spontaneous. And so there's a buoyancy for me when I talk about play. And I also want to be playful in serious moments as well, like intense moments. I naturally am intense, and it served me well, but I also, I want a counterbalance and a counter rotation to be more buoyant, to be, the image is like, have more space. So there's a widening of my, the playground that I can have fun in inside of myself. And so spontaneity is what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
A Navy SEALs operator of team five said to me, when something, and he was completely serious, Pete Nashak, I love you. He said, when something matters to you, you'll do whatever it takes. That changed me. And I was like, yeah, that's it. And so that this matters to me. And so I'm going to put in the work.
All right. I call this my final five. Five final questions. First thought that comes to mind. And away we go.
Okay.
Cool. Number one, best advice you've ever received.
First thing that comes to mind is that I loathe advice.
Worst advice you've ever received.
Okay. Worst advice. It's gone. I've not held on to that. And so there's nothing there.
Leadership, number three. Born with it? Trained?
Trained. Yeah, it's, I mean, you're born with height and eye color. You know, you're born with some genetic coding, but not leadership. And so it is, there's a whole substack of capabilities that are part of leadership. And so it's as much philosophical as it is technical. And so there's psychological skills, there's a philosophy that guides it, and there's a set of practices to be consistent. And it is 100% something that we can build.
Show's titled The It Factory. Dive into The It Factor. So many people have it. Here we are another year since we had you on the show. We asked you the same question. I'll ask you again. How would you define your It Factor?
Such a good question. But and I think it's that animation of oneself that is expressed in the present moment that is fully authentic. And so it's not somebody that walks in and is like preempted how they want to show up. There's a, I'll go back to the word spontaneity, but there's an being on time with the unfolding present moment. And when somebody is in that space, which is incredibly rare, and we just recognize it, like there's something special about that person. You know what's special? They're fully authentically present in the unfolding moment. And from that place, others recognize that how rare and special it is. And we call it something. We call it the It Factor.
I've borrowed this question from you. You utilize this question. So I'm going to ask you this question as the final one. Finish the sentence. You know the question. It all comes down to,
yeah. This moment. You know, the unfolding nature of this moment. It all comes down to how you and I, in this case, are co-creating this moment. Yeah. And the present moment is the easy answer for me. And then I can also get totally down with it all comes down to love. It all comes down with experience. So it's those three that tend to hang with me for that question. So the unfolding present moment, the experience that is taking place, and the virtue of love that I want to make sure is part of how I'm operating. So for me, that's it.
That's good, man. So many things to continue to ask you about, but we're not going to, because the end of this episode of The It Factory. But Mike, thanks for allowing us into your studio. Check out Finding Mastery for all those that haven't. I'm sure they already are listening to it. I hope they are. I know you got a book coming out.
I do.
2023.
Harvard Business Review. It is on the science and application of what I think is one of the greatest human constrictors of potential, which is this obsession about worrying about what other people think of us.
Cannot wait to have that in my hands. And when it comes out, let us know. Bring it back on the show if you have time.
We're not getting off this podcast until I say thank you for the generosity to support and challenge me to stay the path of sharing the ideas publicly. And so it's been loads of fun and in unimaginable ways to have this podcast. And this happened because of you. So I want to say thank you, brother.
Yeah, bro. Back in the day, the space between.
The space between.
All right. We're out of here, man. Thanks, bro. See you in the water.
Appreciate you.
Whew. Well, as we knew it would be, PJ with Dr. Michael Gervais, it would be a powerful conversation. Welcome to the Afterglow, where we talk about the conversation, What do we wish we asked? What do we miss on? What do we learn? TJ, you were in the room there in the Finding Mastery studio. It was a road trip for us. What did you take away in real time? And then what were you thinking about as you were editing this episode back?
It was fun. I mean, it's cool to be there real time, especially for a conversation like that. That's so powerful. And like when you really can kind of feel it in the moment, like there's something different about being there and really getting to feel that conversation. But it's not two screens. You're in it. One of the most powerful things, well, there's a lot of powerful stuff in that. Let's be real. But one of the most powerful things I took away was it was near the beginning, and I took it away when he said it, and then it kind of reconfirmed it when I've been editing this, was when he was talking about like branding of psychology and stuff like that. But the interesting part was when he was talking about sports psychology, he said, is the study of human flourishing. And it was really interesting at how he kind of harped on like, and people think about, when you think of psychology, you think of people hurting and how he was talking about that, but how sports psychology is different. It's that can be part of it, but it's also like the study of people flourishing, which I thought was really, really cool. And one of the things that I think I would have loved to know when he was talking about, when he gave you the example of when he speaks to crowds and about bringing people up and kind of seeing like, everyone's like, oh yeah, I want to do that. And then he's like, all right, let's test it. And then he's like, who wants to bring it up? And he said, far fewer hands go up. Well, he said some of the groups he talks to are athletes and some of the groups he talks to are like business people and stuff like that. So I want to know, like, and I don't know if he has like asked people this, but the people that do go up there, how many of their backgrounds were in sport? Because I would love to know, like, because I just feel like as we've talked about on the show, sometimes athletes' mindset's a little different where it's like they almost could kind of see that as like a challenge of like, oh, yeah, I could go up there. Like, I could do that. Kind of how he was talking about athletes expect that they can do even more than they might be able to do. So I would have loved to know that too.
Yeah. I've known Mike, as we talked about on the show, for over a decade now, almost 15 years, I guess. Yeah, 2009 wow. We met. And every time I walk away from a conversation with him, I feel as though I became better. And now as like a parent and a husband and have this other part of my life that I didn't have when he and I met, I'm like trying to grasp, and you could hear in the conversation, I'm like, so like, how about like coaching kids? Like whatever it was. And I really enjoyed the lens of this one and the framework, which was, I was going to be a parent, I was going to be a coach, and I was going to be a player. So I hope everybody who heard that not only heard it from whatever lens they're currently living, but also to gain some empathy for the other lens of the player if you're a parent, or of the coach if you're an athlete, et cetera. I thought that was cool. What I loved also was how he referenced his word of the year, and drum roll, please, boom, 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 right? TJ, you and I here in our second season of The It Factor, we've done this every year. We've teased our word of the year and then revealed it. We're going to do that today. Mike talked about his being joy and really trying to play and really being play and having more fun in his career and his professional and personal life. As you heard him describe his word of the year, I want to hear yours, and then I'll share what mine is here in 2023.
Okay. All right. Well, so last year, we'll go back to last year. Last year, my word of the year was patience. And I remember telling you, and you've worked with me long enough to know that like, I don't necessarily have the best patience, but I've been working on it. And I think last year I could successfully say that like, I worked on patience. It's gotten better. It's still a long way to go, but it's gotten better. So, but the interesting part is that patience led to me kind of taking steps into what this word of the year is, which is growth, and being able to, all right, now we've had that patience, we're waiting, we're not just trying to force things, but waiting for that moment. And now we grow into the next step. Now, like, as you've mentioned, like I'm now down here with you in LA and like kind of growing and taking that next step into just life in general. So I think this year's word of the year is growth.
Growth. All right. Patience and growth, right? Right. That's the old story of the bamboo, right?
Yep.
It takes 2 years of incremental growth, patience, and then whoop, away it goes. So, all right. I know where to follow up with you offline in that one. Of course, we want to hear your words of the year. For me, and Mike was the catalyst of this, when we were in the water, literally surfing in the Pacific a decade ago, we were talking about like, hey, like, let's have a word of the year. And we both agreed that the word in year one, 10 years ago, was going to be go. And it was the year of go. And we were just going to go as hard as we could, say yes to everything, right? Whether it's every opportunity, professionally, personally, what have you. And we both just went and after 365 days, just lay there exhausted. And every year since then, I've been adding to that word and that narrative. And this year was really hard for me, to be honest, because I didn't find a lot or I didn't create a lot of time to think about what would it be. And it was over the holiday break. It was after Rose Bowl Media Day, where I just posted up at a cafe by myself and I just sat there with my journal and I was like, all right, really, let's think it through. Like, you have all these thoughts running through your mind. Where do you want to go? And my word last year, as you know, and listeners may, it was flow. And my mantra had been move with intent and go with the flow. And if I looked at my vision board to my right, that's what it would state. And I love that. It was one of the most fruitful years of my life because of that word. So this year was a challenge. And really, as I thought about it and meditated on it and used a lot of the practices that Dr. Gervais shared in our podcast episode, for me, it's roots, connect to my roots, whether it's family, community, football, things I just love, recovery, because I got to learn how to recover better, right? That sleep, I want to be around for a long time. I got two young kids. Chris Peterson, who was just on our podcast, he talked about recovery. He challenges me a lot on, hey, how are you recovering from a game, from a show, from just parenthood, what have you? Roots, recovery, and reach. And reach is all about taking big swings. And it's a really fun year here in 2023, right? Like, we know what's going on in Pac-12 football. There's going to be a change. We know what's going on in the media landscape. There's going to be some adjustment. Nothing's going to stay stagnant. Nothing ever does, but definitely this year, there'll be big change. So for me, it's about reach. Like, how can I creatively reach? How can I reach further into my own knowledge as a parent? How can I dive further and reach into research to learn how to be a better dad, how to be a better analyst, how to be a better storyteller, how to be a better podcast host, what have you. So it's roots, recovery, and reach. And I like it because it's a little aggro. And I feel that this year. I feel like, because I could say it, it's because of the podcast, but really, like, the essence is like, I want to go try to kick some ass. And I was like, all right, how do I make that in a cool phrase or a word that makes sense to me that I can think about every day? And it's literally, that's what I meditate on every morning. Roots, recovery, and reach. So there it is.
I love that. I absolutely love that. I have no doubt that you will succeed in all of those. And like you said, since this podcast, we can say, I'll have no doubt that you'll kick some ass this year. But and one thing, but before we finish up, that I want to go back to on in the episode mentioned it, and I just want to kind of reiterate it. Dr. Gervais said he thanked you for being a friend and for having this podcast, but he said he thought it was really cool that this community that you started really focusing on of athletes, coaches, and parents, like you did in this episode and kind of did each version of it, how they have this outlet to go to. And I just wanted to say, I think it's really cool that you, this is something you've really championed as being part of being that place that community can go to and to be a part of it. I thought that was really cool. So I just want to let you know.
Thanks, bro. I think if you're a parent or an athlete or a coach, you want more content, keep coming here. But if you also want to explore your own mental skills, go find Mike at Finding Mastery. Check them out. Their YouTube page. You can look at our stuff on Pac-12 or my own personal channels or TJ's channels. It's really fun to know that we can collaborate with a place like Mike and Finding Mastery to really come to the same space for our audience. So a lot of good stuff out there on the internet. I know it's hard to sift through it all, but if you want some stuff that's going to make you kick some ass, stick right here, man. So with that said, all right, I'm out. This has been a long episode, but that's the deal. That's what you get with Mike Gervais. You can go for a long, long time. The only negative, TJ, is that we could have got like 3 or 4 episodes out of this. So maybe we'll have him back if you want him. Hit us up. Hit us up on our social channels. Make sure you go to the Pac-12 Insider channel. That's Pac-12.com/insider for all past episodes, this one and future ones. And with that, I hope you're living your word of the year. I hope you've chosen one. And if so, let us know. Peace.